Well, thank you again. I am just so grateful to be here, and it's just an honor to be able to be a speaker in this series. I love the title, Mystagogy. It's a word that is very dear to my heart. I actually had a solo show a few years ago called Mystagogia. And so I love this word, the study of mystery, right? This early church practice of really unpacking the mysteries of our faith. And so it's an honor to be here, and I'm excited to unpack the mysteries of George Rouleau's life and of his work with all of you tonight. So I wanted to just kind of make note of a couple things. I have these packets. You all got one, and so I'll reference it throughout the talk. But if nothing else, there'll be beautiful images that you can look at more later at home and get to contemplate and take home with you. So I just encourage you to kind of keep your eyes there too. Beautiful. So I want to start this talk with a quote, and this is from someone who was in your series earlier this spring, Flannery O'Connor. "All human nature vigorously resists grace because grace changes us, and the change is painful." So I'll read that one more time. "All human nature vigorously resists grace because grace changes us, and the change is painful." So grace and the grotesque, devotional art in the heart of the world. This title for the talk that I chose is meaningful. I think there's so much that we can learn from grace and the way that different writers and artists, such as Flannery O'Connor and George Rouleau, have taught us about grace in different ways. And I see a similarity between George Rouleau's work, which I'll get to, and Flannery O'Connor's writings. I think there's something about this element of grace being a very kind of striking, penetrating force. And I'll get to that later. For now, I think what I want to do is just kind of introduce a little bit about my own relationship to George Rouleau, which is very special to me. So if you want to look at your packets on the first page to the left, there's a couple of images. So George Rouleau was introduced to me by a teacher that I had in college named David Johnson. He was a drawing teacher, printmaking teacher that I got to know very well over my 4 years. And at the time in undergrad, I was really trying to sort through this tension between being what I felt there was a tension between being a practicing Catholic, someone who was very engaged and just as a young person trying to learn a lot about what it means to be Catholic and how to reconcile that with becoming kind of a young adult, striking my way into the world, but kind of striking that balance between, okay, I'm a Catholic and I'm practicing these things, excited about that, but also I'm an artist. And just kind of based on a lot of the artist tropes throughout art history and in contemporary times, I didn't think that those two could be one. I thought you have to pick one or the other. Or if you are Catholic and you're an artist, your work has to be limited to a very strict set of rules and guidelines, right? That my work needed to look like it came out of the Renaissance, or have this like very specific iconography. And so that was very, daunting for me. So I kind of went through this weird, like awkward time in college. And some of my teachers noticed that. And Dave, my teacher, who's in this picture towards the top, there's a student behind him who's a friend of mine named Teddy, who's playing around. But Dave was just w encouraged me to really look into George Rouleau and to get to know his life and his work, because he was an artist who, he told me, it was known for being religious without being religios, which I thought was such an interesting way of saying it. Like, his work is just completely infused with his faith and with his spirituality without being too on the nose, or without being too saccharine, or trying to just stay in one movement of art history and never coming out, just kind of staying frozen there, which is what I thought it meant to be a Catholic and to be an artist at that time. And so I'm very grateful for my teacher, and just wanted to kind of share a little bit of that personal element that I have. This relationship with George Rouleau that began so long ago in college, maybe about 10 years now. And so George Rouleau, he's a painter, he's a printmaker, he's an artist who's fully engaged in the ever-present search for the presence of Christ at the center of all things. So with this talk, what I want to do is trace the moments of grace in the life of George Rouault, which is a life that I would propose as a model for any artist who's living in the heart of the world today, right? Especially being in New York City, I would say there's something about, of course, this place, especially if you're an artist, you find yourself here, you feel like you're kind of in the heart of the world, or like you're in the belly of the whale, or some combination of the two. It just feels like you're in something, and it's very important, it's very fiery, but it's easy to kind of get lost in one direction or another, to have the sail of your ship sort of moved with the winds of the trends of the art world, or of evils or temptations that come up as an artist, or to be pushed, if you're lucky, to be pushed in the way of faith and of grace really breaking through your life and through your experiences as an artist. So that's what I mean when I say living in the heart of the world. And I also kind of steal that from St. Teresa of Calcutta. She said about her sisters, her missionaries of charity, that they were contemplatives in the heart of the world. I love that phrase, and I like to relate it to artists as well. This also is just he's such a dear artist to me, George Rouault, thinking about, you know, being in the heart of the world, being in Paris, being an artist of faith, really immersed in this vision. As the founder of Art House Tubi, which Father Francis mentioned. So this is a community of artists that's seeking to really transform the culture around us. But we know that that has to start within first. It has to start with transformation of the heart of the artist. And so in my work with Art House Tubi, I'm overseeing a lot of artwork that's being created by performers, artists of all kinds who are collaborating with this shared vision to create an art that is not that's not just stuck in one kind of era or stuck in a sort of a sterile kind of framework, but that's truly living and that's really present and seeking the heart of Christ in the world and really seeking to reveal that through their work, through their craft that is new, always new. And so with that, kind of moving into Rouault's life and how we can start to kind of think with the mind of an artist, and especially an artist of today who is really looking to find ways to model their life after a very holy person who's pursuing something similar. I want to look at the circumstances of Rouault's life, the circumstances that allowed for grace to pour in and to radiate through his work. And these will be circumstances of the world and of his personal life and of his faith. So let's dive in. So a little bit of background. Rouault was born in 1871 and lived in a working-class suburb of Paris called Bellevue. And as he was growing up, he already had this interest and excitement in craft. His father was a cabinet maker, and his mother also helped kind of encourage his artistic interests. He became a stained glass apprentice for 5 years from the age of 14 through 19. And that's important. A lot of people think that his work ends up being inspired by his work as a stained glass maker, sort of the bold lines, the very vibrant colors. And so it's important to note that this moment of his childhood and being engaged and enraptured in this history of craft that's very deep in the church's history also. And he was like really in that with his whole self from a very young age. He goes to study at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, so a school of arts, decorative arts. And he studies under Gustave Moreau. Gustave Moreau is an important artist, teacher, mentor, and a friend to Rouault in these very early years of his life. Moreau is a very famous symbolist painter. So symbolism, if you haven't heard of it, is a late 19th century artistic and literary movement that focused on showing narratives and emotions through symbols rather than through realism or through impressionism, which were both popular at the time in France. And so if you want to look in your packet, if you want to flip to the next page, here I just have a couple of images that outline some of George's influences. So we have some of this kind of amazing medieval stained glass and prints. And I like to think about George Rouault, again, from an early age as a stained glass maker and then into his work studying in Paris. You know, he's surrounded by these sorts of influences, and maybe thinking back too to his childhood growing up in various kind of seeing churches where he lived, really being drawn in by that mystery and by that style and by the face of medieval France. And then on the right, I have an example of his teacher, Gustave Moreau's painting, The Apparition, which is a watercolor. And this image is actually of St. John the Baptist's head. So Salome and St. John the Baptist. So after the beheading happens and Salome goes and presents the head, this is Gustave Moreau's depiction of that. So it's sort of fanciful. It's a little dreamlike. It's kind of strange, very decorative. So that's the world that Gustave Moreau lives in, and the way that he's teaching his students too. And he was very big on teaching about really embracing the inner freedom of the inner voice of the artist, of the vision that an artist has that's very unique to them. And I like this quote, kind of thinking about Moreau's relationship and encouragement to Rouault in this regard. I think back to the scripture quote from St. Paul, "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free." So Moreau is encouraging Rouault to explore his own voice, his own inner life, but also to explore the inner life and the world within his subjects that he's painting. And Rouault, in a writing, recalls Moreau's teaching that the artist's role was to defend the rights of the imagination and the inner vision over and against visible reality. So that's important, this whole bit about Moreau, because he becomes very close with Rouault. And even though Moreau isn't practicing Catholic and has his own sorts of like gripes with the church, so to speak, Rouault takes the good from that philosophy that his teacher has and runs with it. He takes that, you know, embracing this inner freedom, allowing himself to really explore his artistic vision and to be very open in a very free way interiorly to the work that God will do in his life, which is really beautiful. And so actually another kind of interesting point here, right? So George Rouault is Catholic. He's baptized Catholic, but what a lot of people don't know is that he was actually raised in a secular environment. So even though he's baptized Catholic, he doesn't end up receiving communion or any formal training in the faith until he's 24 years old, and he seeks it out for himself and actually finds a Dominican priest to help him with that. So shout out to the Dominicans. And so just want to note that too. I think that's really important. Conversion is happening for Rouault in these years of his artistic training. So he's exploring his craft. He's learning from Moreau, his teacher. He's around all of these amazing intellectuals and other artists. He went to school with Matisse, for example, all these great people. And in the midst of that, a conversion is happening in his heart, which is so cool and like so unexpected. I'm always amazed when I've met a few people recently like this who had insane, really cool conversions to the Catholic Church during their undergrad art school experience. And I'm always like, how? Like, that's really amazing and so beautiful. But I do think like God uses those cracks that are opening for an artist who's really exploring and very excited and open to the world around them to reach them if they let him, and if they're open to that and they have the eyes to see it. So it's also interesting, this context that he's living in France. It's really interesting timing, his conversion, I think. He has his conversion in 1895, and then later in 1901, we have in France the Law of Associations that goes through. So it's this legislation that would limit Catholic teaching religious orders and would begin the separation of church and state in France which would more formally happen in 1905. So we have a lot of this silencing of the church, religious orders that are moving out and having to kind of pack up and figure out a different something else to do, some another program. And so there's a lot of strife happening within the context of Rouault's time with church and state. At the same time, often when these things happen, right, we also see a revival of Catholic thought and arts and culture as a response, as sort of a counter response to that. So there's a Catholic revival that's sort of underway in response in artists and writer circles that George Rouault becomes acquainted with. So right after the Law of Associations goes through in 1901, he found a group of Catholic writers and artists who had begun to work out of a monastery to create a community of Catholic artists, stepping away from the world in order to focus on creating a more authentic Catholic art. So it's kind of interesting. This is happening like months before this other thing goes through that separates, that starts to kind of silence the church and put that away. So because of the political situation, once that law goes through, the group dissolves and that dream ends. But I do think that this is maybe a moment of grace. So maybe one of these kind of first moments of grace after his conversion for Rouault, because it sent him back into Paris and into the heart of the world, where his work was perhaps needed more, rather than being kind of cooped away with like-minded people, which is awesome. Also, in its own way, we need those moments to like be nourished and receive, but also we have to go out, we have to be missionaries and live out of our baptismal call to go out and preach the good news to all nations. So anyway, so I think that that's another kind of moment of grace in George Rouault's life. He's kind of forced back into the world. So this phrase, moments of grace, or what our friend Flannery O'Connor would call assaults of grace. Flannery would remind us that moments of grace aren't always pretty or come at a time when we expect it, right? Often they're a little tough and they come at very dark moments. And that is precisely where God wants to be with us. That's where he's closest with us. So just a word about this before we get into some moments or some assaults of grace in George Rouault's life. This makes me think a lot about the dark night of the soul that St. John of the Cross speaks about and writes about. This reality of really looking at my life circumstances in the face, especially in circumstances of loss and pain, and to embrace the cross that I'm being given and to lean into that reality of loss. And so when an artist does this, we can see this time and time again throughout art history. This leads to immense artistic and spiritual fruit and to new depths of vision of self, fellow man, and of God. Grace has an opening here. It has a crack with which to break through. And we see this in St. John of the Cross's story. So he's imprisoned by his religious order and lives in a closet-shaped-sized kind of cell for 9 months, in this dark, dirty, grimy little cell. And during that time, he spends that time in prison just singing and drafting in his mind and kind of verbalizing this poem, lots of poems, but one poem that ends up becoming his classic, The Spiritual Canticle. So beautiful, so cool. I just love to imagine him, this artist, cooped up in this what would be kind of the darkest moment of his life in a lot of people's eyes. He's creating. There's inspiration is happening in the void. And I think that artists have this really particular and beautiful call to be there and to let that happen, let that experience happen, and to reveal fruit, to be open to what the creation that God wants to work out with us in that, to give to others. It's a cool quote from Fra Angelico. He who wishes to paint Christ's story must live with Christ. I think about this quote in relation to another assault of grace in George Rouault's life. So He has this personal tragedy where Gustave Moreau, his teacher, who he loved so much, passes away in 1898. So here, Rouault loses his spiritual support up to this point, and his teacher. He loses his studio where he's making his work, and he lives alone because his family moves to Algeria at the same time. So it's kind of simultaneously all these really hard things are happening. So here we start to see a shift in the artist's approach and in the aesthetics and the subject matter that he works with. But this must begin with an interior transformation and a journey within the artist's soul, if it is to hold its weight and if it's to produce any spiritual nourishment for the viewer. So we start to see a shift from exploring mythology and religious subjects from an academic approach to a more human and incarnational approach. We can see that visually in his work. So a living faith starts to be translated into the form, the color, the design, and the visual and the interior understanding of the human person. And it's unfolding right before Rouault's eyes onto his canvas. So from a strictly academic sense, Rouault had become skilled as a painter and in his knowledge of historic events and mythology through school. However, he reflects in this period, "But I had not taken the time to watch people and life. I was acquainted with religious history and had painted the dead Christ and Jesus among the doctors, but I knew nothing of suffering." There's another quote. This one is by his teacher, Gustave Moreau. "A painter should be grateful if he was poor, for it is difficult for a person to sense the wonder and horror where all the world lives if he has never been down with them." So Rouault describes this experience in this way. So during this kind of tough time in his life, he's lonely, poor, sort of wandering the streets, starving artist sort of trope. "Without warning, to forget all that I had loved in the museums, little by little, a more objective vision sustained me. I underwent at that time a most violent moral crisis. I experienced things that cannot be put into words, and I set about to paint with an outrageous lyricism that upset everyone. In spite of this, I sent some pictures to the salon. I had, it seems to me, a perfect disregard for what was happening to me. In order for me to realize that an evolution was taking place, I had to read an article that said, 'There used to be a Rouault who was a serious painter, but now there is another who is a joker.' It was my detractors that helped me to understand what I had done. But I wanted to tell them, if they had had less prejudice, that this instinctive movement, this turn of the helm, was not under the influence of Lautrec or Degas or the moderns. It was rather by an inner need and the wish, perhaps unconscious, not to fall into the mold of conventional religious subjects." Later, he says, "When I was about 30, I felt a stroke of lightning or of grace, depending on one's perspective. The face of the world changed for me. I saw everything that I had seen before, but in a different form and with a different harmony." So the artist's own reflection on this transformation of his vision because of grace, because of this experience that he allowed himself to embrace, to really lean into, that God was allowing to happen in his life. So I want to turn now to his subject matter that starts to come out of this period, and in particular, that word grotesque from the title of my talk. And again, I love to think back to Flannery O'Connor. She was so amazing at depicting the grotesque and letting that be an instrument and a tool that she used in order to depict very, very deep and penetrating truths that are hard for us to look at. So the grotesque. "Clowns, prostitutes, and corrupt judges. These are all subjects that Rouault explored really throughout his whole life, but really started to explore more during this period. And you can check out, there's a few images I included in the packet on the next page. So the inspiration to explore these subjects began in this assault of grace that the artist had experienced in his daily life. This requires an open and reverent gaze on reality, a gaze that really we're all called to cultivate as disciples of Christ and as participators in the ongoing story of redemption. And it's also a gaze that is uniquely gifted to artists, I would propose. So the subject of prostitutes, this was tough for a lot of people during his time. It's not that other artists weren't doing paintings of prostitutes. For example, I think of Henri Toulouse-Lautrec, who did so many posters and paintings and drawings from brothels where, you know, there's these kind of flamboyant, beautiful, vibrant scenes. It looks so fun and great. And you know, like artists during his time had different visions of prostitutes and depicted them in these sort of surface level ways. Or they depicted them as just victims to be, to be taken advantage of or to just feel sorry for. And that's kind of it. It's like two dimensional or something is what I would say. And so there's a moment of grace that happens that inspires this subject and that kind of helps him get deeper into what is his vision of the human person in front of him who's a prostitute. He recalls passing by a doorway where a woman is offering herself to a passerby. This isn't the first time that he's witnessed prostitution on the streets of Paris. Prostitutes were also known to pose in the studio with artists that he frequented at the time and to warm themselves there when they were cold. So what is it about this moment? Rouault says, "For me, it was the shock, the suggestion. I saw this bluish lady just as anyone else can, though more clearly since I am a painter. When I returned home, this began to work on me. The spectacle I happened upon was transposed, a transposition or perhaps a call from the inner world. Nothing was premeditated. Thus, the woman seen in the door is not the one I painted. That one and the others corresponded to the state of mind I was in." So again, the artist's vision and moments of grace, we can't really anticipate it. It just sort of happens where something just strikes you on the street or wherever you are, just meets you exactly where you are. That's that working of grace. So he proceeds to, I like this quote from one of his critics. He proceeds to make of them, the prostitutes, the image not of the error, but of the pain of sin. I think that's a really great kind of, just gets right into that, the purpose. Proceeds to make of them the image not of the error, but of the pain of sin. So he's revealing a mystery, God's image within the suffering. There's another critic who says, "When he paints a joyful female, Rouault does not cruelly enjoy, unlike Lautrec, the vice that her body exhales. He suffers and weeps for it." So with his vision of the human person and all of these different facets, he's not being didactic. He's being very nuanced, and I think there's more there than meets the eye. It's a little more complicated than I think just often, it's hard to look at an image of a woman who's selling her body, but for Rouault, there's like a transformation that's happening that allows him to have this vision and to present it to the world as a new way of seeing and of experiencing divine grace and also of presenting sin and its truth. He's someone who's really deep down and engaged with a living reality that's within himself and without, and seeing the threads of light and grace in the mix of the void of pain and darkness right in front of him. I would say this is an incarnational and a contemplative vision. I think it's perhaps confusing and maybe paradoxical. Yeah, but also the life and the vision of Christ is as well. There's so many paradoxes in the gospel and in the way that Christ saw people and the way that he treated them and loved them. And so I think that this is a vision that George Rouleau really cultivated, whether he wanted to or not. He was set on a journey to do that. We're all really called to stare these realities in the face and to search for the living flame of Christ's heart at the very core of it all. Artists have a particular responsibility and a vocation to search for this unrelenting presence in all things and at all moments, and to transmit this vision to the world, to give nourishment to the world, spiritual nourishment. To be a prophet or a mouthpiece of truth for the world around us, no matter how penetrating or hard to face that truth might be. This is another Rouleau quote. I carry within myself an infinite depth of suffering and melancholy, which life has only served to develop, and of which my painting, if God allows it, will only be the flowering and imperfect expression. I love that. There's another quote I want to share, and this one is in relation to clowns, to his interest in clowns. There's an image in your packet, the three clowns, which I picked because I found it, and to me it just looked like an image of the Trinity, like an icon of the Trinity or something, like Andrei Rublev's icon. Just these three clowns that are holding each other, but that have distinct presences in themselves, so sort of creating this communion. So I'll read from what Rouleau shares about his moment of grace with the clown. That gypsy wagon stopped along the road, the emaciated old horse grazing on the thin grass, the old clown sitting on the corner of his wagon, mending his bright, many-colored costume. This contrast between brilliant and scintillating things made to amuse us, and this infinitely sad life, if one looks at it objectively, struck me with great force. I have expanded all of this. I saw clearly that the clown was myself, ourselves, almost all of us. This spangled costume is given to us by life. We are all of us clowns, more or less. We all wear a spangled costume. But if we are caught by surprise, the way I caught that old clown, oh, then, who would dare to claim he is not moved deeply by immeasurable pity? My failing, if it is one, in any case, it is a source of immense suffering for me, is never to let anyone keep on his spangled costume. Be he king or emperor, what I want to see in the man facing me is his soul. And the more exalted his position, the more I fear for his soul. Beautiful. He's such a poet, isn't he? So deep. So beautiful. I love that moment. Again, another assault of grace, like with the prostitute. His reflection there and sharing about this interest in revealing the human person that's behind the mask, behind the costume. So over Rouleau's career, clowns become, they sort of evolve the way that he depicts them in the pictorial frame. So he is doing a lot of these sort of whole body images of clowns and really of all of his subjects, not just clowns. But later in life, as time goes on, the clowns, the heads become closer and closer up. So to the point that there's all of these studies of just like the heads of clowns. And he does a similar thing with Christ, with the head of Christ. So many images of Christ that are just cropped at the head that Rouleau created. And I think that's really interesting. Because I think with that close-up, you know, he's like starting to emphasize less, here's this clown, here's their novelty, here's their like prop over here that they're playing with, whatever. kind of the amusement of this figure. But seeing that he has a new relationship to the subject, and that he's really trying to see the person in front of him and to reveal that soul behind the mask. And I would say something else to note with that is we can gather that Ruo is seeing, as time goes on, more and more the presence of Christ within the person in front of him, and is in the least really seeking that. I think it's a lifelong search for him, really trying to go into a closer intimacy with Christ and letting that intimacy begin with the people that he's painting, the people in front of him. It's beautiful. One of Ruo's friends, Jacques Maritain, who's an amazing, you know, very interesting French writer and thinker of the time, said to another artist, Jean Cocteau, who was a French poet who led a very interesting life sort of in and out of the church at different times. He wrote to him in a letter. This is when Jean Cocteau was really kind of struggling to figure out what does it mean to be an artist who's interested in the church and who has a life in the church, but who wants to live their art fully and freely. So Jacques Maritain says, "Church art, which makes objects before which one prays, owes it to itself to be religious, theological. Beyond this particular and lofty case, it is quite true that God does not ask this of religious art or Catholic art. The art that he wants for himself is art, with all its teeth." So here he's really trying to give Cocteau this inspiration and sort of an encouragement. You don't have to make church art, what he calls church art. The art that God is interested from him is art with all of its teeth. I love that phrase. Not holding anything back. And so an artist who is able to thrive in the tension between traditional and the new, who is at the avant-garde, this is a great balancing act and a beautiful tension to live in. This is unusual for Ruo's time amongst other 20th century modern art movements to be creating a devotional art that comes from an authentic place. There's a lot of artists who are creating art about religious subjects, either in a mocking manner or in a manner that's just interested in kind of the aesthetic quality of it or the iconography or the history, but not necessarily coming from a deep spiritual, from a heart that's really interested in a life in the church. And then also just to note again that the political context in France, with the separation of church and state, right? There's a lot happening there. And just again, on a personal note, another reason why Ruo is so dear to me and to the mission of Art House TV and why I co-founded Art House so long ago is because of artists like Ruo, who really live out this artistic integrity and who have given us an opening or have opened up a landscape for future waves of artists, Catholic artists, to be able to live in that tension unashamedly, no matter what people say, but to really be able to dive deep into our faith and be able to create work that lives in that tension between the tradition and what's new, what's ever new that the Holy Spirit wants to create through us. So Ruo, he's faithful to this voice that he would say is imposed from within. A voice that's imposed from something or someone greater than himself. There's a quote from Jacques Maritain's wife, Raissa Maritain, that I want to share in this regard. She says, "This impulsion," so his impulsion to create amidst criticism from other artists and even friends of his within the church and outside of the church. This impulsion then came from an inner necessity that was founded on his faith. Ray also describes him as struggling toward a personal form of art adequate to his deepest need, that which was uniquely true for him, uniquely authentic. He was penetrated by the absolute demands and postulates of his faith. It was a faith that was simple and profound, perhaps like that of the builders of the cathedrals. It's beautiful. So, mixed reviews from critics in the art world and in the church at various points throughout his life. Léon Bloy, who was a prominent French Catholic writer at the time and a good friend of Rouault's, was known to have criticized and never understood Rouault's work, and was often very upfront about that with him and sometimes in front of other people. But Rouault just, he went through this purifying fire that all artists of faith must go through at some point. The trial of remaining faithful to one's inner vision and inspiration, despite trends, public acceptance, or financial strain. He does, though, reach some acclaim during his life, of course. He ends up being honored by Pope Pius XII as a papal knight towards the end of his life. But definitely, he had his share of criticism. A shared experience by so many Catholic artists that I know, but an experience that's not to be lamented. It's to be entered into and to be entered into alongside other artists who are experiencing the same thing and can lift each other up. So not to kind of make a victim of Rouault. I don't want to do that, but to just give that truth, that is what he experienced, and that's what so many artists experience. His father's death in 1912 was another assault of grace. And his death was this grief period that he had after his father's death was this initial impetus for his Miserere et Gere series, which is regarded as his masterpiece. And this is in your packets on the next page. There's two images. So he begins the series in 1914, and he finishes in 1927. It began as about 106 prints total, but ends up additioning about 58. And so as he's working on this, World War I breaks out, so that impacts it as well. It's a really beautiful series and feels like a very fully fleshed out passion of sorts. So with this series, there's an emphasis on the sufferings of humanity interwoven with the sufferings of Christ. So there's images of people having these different kind of ordinary experiences or who are struggling in some way. But then there will also be images of Christ on the cross or a very overtly religious imagery and iconography. And that's purposeful. Rouault wants to help us see that Christ is with us and is with each of us when we're suffering, especially through things like world wars. And so these two images I put, they're two of my favorites. This one on the left, all of them have titles that are really interesting and poetic, kind of get to a truth. This one is, "Sometimes the blind have comforted those who see." And then on the right, "Wars, dread of mothers." There's something very elegant about these images, although they are very intense and very kind of punched to the gut. So I encourage you all to Google this series and take time with it. There are websites that have all of the images, and they're all so beautiful. But for Rouault, just a note about this series, it was important for him that they be accessible. So he wanted to make sure that these were able to be printed and distributed widely as a series. And so not printed, of course, with a computer. At that time, that wasn't possible. But with printmaking, which is the process that he used for all of these and for so much of his work. So he's using metal plates. He's carving away at the metal plate. He's using different methods to get different shading and lines and to be able to depict something in a very graphic, very saturated way. And so I brought a few examples of prints, just of things that I've done that are on this table here after the talk, if you want to come and check them out. In particular, there's one of Veronica's Veil and one of Christ in the Eucharist with drips coming down into the chalice. Those are both etchings and examples of sort of what the feel or like what the texture of these would have been. So I just brought those as kind of an example for y'all to kind of get close to. So yeah, I love that Ruo is a printmaker and that he feels very strongly that his work be accessible and that these messages get to go out into the world. So just to conclude, I want to end, if you turn to your last page in the packet, there are these beautiful images of Veronica's Veil of the Holy Face. Ruo did so many versions of this, of just Christ's face. It's like he could never quite get to the bottom of that mystery of who is the face of Christ. And I want to read this quote from one of his critics. It says, in the first period of Ruo's artistic life, Ruo's art stressed human depravity. In the second, Christ on the cross, that is, Christ bearing on his visage the sin of man. The face of sinful man, which Ruo took to give to Christ, has been given back to man by the Savior, but redeemed and appeased. Veronica is the one who, by a gesture of pity, has transmitted to man the face of Christ. I think that Veronica's Veil must have been a very deep central meditation for Ruo, especially as a painter and as a printmaker. And I know for me, whenever I meditate on the Station of the Cross, Veronica wiping the face of Christ, it always hits me as an artist in particular, because I feel that so much of my life is just really trying to get to this depiction of Christ's face through portraiture or through images that I'm creating in my studio, really trying to get to the heart of, like, how do I reveal Christ's presence in a really, really raw, really incarnational way through paint on canvas, on fabric, on paper, whatever. Like, how do I get to that and be able to give that to other people to receive? And so for me, Veronica is a beautiful example of someone who's just acting in complete humility at the service of God and of her people in this little gesture. Here's my veil. I want to wipe your face. It was a really beautiful moment that I had here during Daily Mass a few years ago, actually. I was having a really hard time. It's just a very dark time of my life. And I looked up during communion and I saw this man who is a son who's in a wheelchair. And during communion, right before he received communion, I noticed the man just wiped his son's mouth just to kind of get off any whatever saliva. It's a disabled young man right before receiving communion. And it just hit me, that is Veronica with her veil. So it was just that for me was a moment of grace. That was an assault of grace that I needed that week. And that sort of carried me through that dark time that I was having. And so I feel very close to George Ruo in this obsession with Veronica's veil and with really trying to find the face of Christ and being there to wipe the face as an artist and to reveal his face to the world through the simple means that I have as an artist to co-create with God. And so I want to end with this note on humility, which is, I believe, the ultimate call for every artist that resounds through the centuries of artists in the history of the church, who, like Rouault, were servants to their inner vision, led in the darkness by the light of the living flame at the center of all things. And this is graffitied in catacombs of the early church. This is written in the egg tempera of icons and carved into medieval cathedrals, whose builders, Rouault, wrote about identifying very deeply with. Rather than carving his own name into the cathedral facade, the builder carves, "No nobis domine, sed nomini, tuo da gloriam." Not unto us, Lord, but unto thy name be the glory. Not unto us, Lord, but unto thy name be the glory. So with that, let us take Rouault's life as an example for all of us, but in particular in the way that we view and approach artwork, even if we don't understand it right away, and how we engage with everyone that we meet and see Christ in each person. Thank you so much.